Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A decade ago, on September 29th, 2008, the U.S. stock market crashed. On October 3rd, Congress passed the bank bailout known as the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and by October 9th, U.S. unemployment peaked at 10%, and everyone was talking about the recession. Although the downturn wasn't quite as painful in New Hampshire as elsewhere, it still hurt, and the Granite State's recovery felt especially long and slow. Today in The Exchange, it's our economic news roundup, and we'll spend some time looking back a decade ago, plus how our state's economy has changed since then. Later, we examine the intersection between job growth and population growth, also how all these trends may be reshaping our transportation debates. As always, we welcome your input. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me, Laura.
Also with us, Brian Gottlob, principal of Polycon Research, an economic research firm based in Dover. Brian, good to see you. Thank you.
Great to be here, Laura.
And also with us, Russ Thibault, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm in Laconia. And Russ, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Thanks.
Well, gentlemen, just to sort of put us in the time machine and go back a decade, let's hear a little bit from a speech from then-President Bush. This is on September 24th, 2008, so right around this time. And here he is acknowledging the deep economic anxiety many Americans were feeling at that time.
We've seen triple-digit swings in the stock market. Major financial institutions have teetered on the edge of collapse, and some have failed. As uncertainty has grown, many banks have restricted lending. Credit markets have frozen, and families and businesses have found it harder to borrow money. We are in the midst of a serious financial crisis, and the federal government is responding with decisive action.
Again, that's President Bush, September 24th, 2008. And in a minute, guys, we'll talk about what that decisive action was. But Russ, just jump into the time machine. What do you remember from that time as an economist? What were you looking at?
Well, it was really frightening. When Lehman Brothers collapsed, we were on the verge of really an international depression. And I think that the interesting thing in looking back from today is that it really did become a bipartisan type recovery. Bush started it and Obama continued it. But it was when Lehman Brothers failed, Bear Stearns right on the verge of failing, banks just pulled back and weren't lending. People were nationally, you know, having a very difficult time finding credit. Here in New Hampshire, during the downturn, we had maybe 20, 25,000 homes go through foreclosure. We lost personal income for the first time in years. 30,000 jobs evaporated. So it was really, it's called the Great Recession. And there wasn't a big difference between the Great Recession and another depression at that time. That was the fear.
Well, a little bit later, we'll dig into some of the state-focused details you mentioned, Russ. And I'm glad you mentioned housing and financial institutions. We should definitely talk about those. What were you looking at 10 years ago, Brian?
I feel like I was a fighter pilot. I've never flown a jet fighter, but when all those alarms start going off, you know, and all the lights start blinking, that's kind of the way I felt. There were so many things that were going wrong at that time. 5 days before the stock market crashed, I did a presentation September 24th to a bank board of trustees.
The same day we played that clip from President Bush.
And,
yeah, go ahead.
And so I said I was really nervous. You know, you saw the delinquencies that were rising. You saw banks that were starting to get runs where depositors were so worried they were withdrawing their savings. And I said, you know, this is really scary. You know, and I wonder if this is going to happen in New Hampshire. And the bank president interrupted me and he said, Brian, I spent all morning talking to my depositors who had called, wondering if they should take their money out of our bank. That's how scary it was. And that's a small community bank in New Hampshire.
Wow. What were you looking at, Jeff?
You know, actually, it's interesting because I know that we did a lot of reporting going back about 2007, about over a year before that, about this rash of people, homeowners who've been underwater. They had these fancy mortgages that we later found out, you know, gave the name subprime, and people who really probably shouldn't have had
toxic mortgages.
Yeah, and they probably shouldn't have had home mortgages. They had been buying homes for $300,000, and their income was nowhere near that ability to pay for that. And it was mostly through that one company called Countrywide, which was one of the casualties of this. I guess they called it a Great Recession, but it was, as at the time, we felt like it was a depression, and it was that kind of a frightening era. The other thing that what was striking was we track bankruptcies every month. And going around the time of Lehman, you know, after that, all of a sudden you started noticing an uptick in personal bankruptcies and business bankruptcies in New Hampshire, and it was starting to rise. It obviously became much worse 09, 10, 11, but we started seeing that, and things have been going so well in New Hampshire and around the country, like it was almost like, what's going on here? It was like noticing something's wrong with, you see dripping come out of your roof all of a sudden. You
right.
Feel like, oh my God, it's going to start caving in.
But then you say,
a minute.
Gee, maybe I should have noticed that dripping.
Yeah, we're looking
the
at these little
there.
Things, and you know, and then we talk to people who are saying, well, you know, everything's going to be fine. You know, New Hampshire's going to be resilient. You know, they gave us the same old stuff they usually give us, but as Brian and Russ are saying, you know there's something with a sense of apprehension.
Go ahead, Brian.
You know, we didn't know we were in a recession in September of 2008. I mean, things were looking bad and the numbers were falling off clearly. But, you know, during that first 9 months, we lost a couple of thousand jobs in New Hampshire. Then you look at what happened after the end of September. 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 jobs were lost in the next 4 or 5 months. It was incredible how rapidly it all fell off. So nobody really knew in September that we were actually in a recession. And, you know, they date the recessions. It's always a historical look back. So a lot of people were saying, well, it's a downturn, but we didn't know it was going to fall off the cliff the way it did.
Russ?
I was thinking that back then what I noticed as an early warning sign was the days on market for housing in New Hampshire was starting to increase. But you also have to remember there was a tremendous positive momentum going into 2008. Home prices had almost doubled since the year 2000 in New Hampshire. It was phenomenal.
So days on market means how many days they
stay
on the market. Yeah,
yeah, that was starting to rise. And I saw that in 2005, 2006, and commented on it then that this is a little scary. And then all of these no-doc loans where people didn't have to document their income. They could just say, well, I think I make about $150,000 a year. Well, that's great. You qualify for a mortgage. So the interesting thing about this recession, I think, one of the interesting things looking back, is that it was a bottoms-up recession, meaning that it started in the mortgage offices of people who were getting into mortgages that they really couldn't sustain. There would be a teaser rate. You only have to pay 2% interest rate. But what was in the fine print was that's going to go up to 5 or 6% in 2 years. And when that happened, people just pulled back. You started having a recession, losing jobs, losing income, and one thing tripped over the other to the point where we really got into a very serious mess.
Well, and we heard President Bush in that clip earlier saying, you know, here's all the stuff that's happening. But then he says, my administration is taking decisive action. On that financial end that you mentioned, Russ, so that decisive action was the Troubled Asset Relief Program, better known as the TARP, or the bank bailout. And boy, we did lots of shows about this. It was very controversial. So I just want to play a little clip from the president saying Congress really needs to pass this.
This rescue effort is not aimed at preserving any individual company or industry. It is aimed at preserving America's overall economy. It will help American consumers and businesses get credit to meet their daily needs and create jobs. And it will help send a signal to markets around the world that America's financial system is back on track.
And I know you all remember this, and the big debate at that time, and Russ, I can see you want to jump in, is that, you know, is this for Wall Street or Main Street? There's the president saying, this is for Main Street, but a lot of people thought, okay, this is a Wall Street bailout, and we don't like that.
Yeah, we needed to have a Wall Street bailout, unfortunately. It would have been a lot better if the aid could have been direct to those homeowners. But what was happening was that these mortgages were packaged together. A lot of them were unsustainable. They were sold internationally, and the entire financial web got literal web, kind of started looking like it was going to decline. And there was more than that. The Fed, for example, did a great job. I mean, looking back, we averted a real disaster. It was really bad, and it was really bad for a lot of households, but we averted a real big disaster. When the Fed, for example, started buying long-term mortgage bonds and provided liquidity, a place for people to cash in their chips, in effect, the Fed Bank, the National Fed Bank here.
People didn't see it that way. People said this is a big bailout for fat cats on Wall Street who got us into this problem in the first place. So,
it was, but we kind of needed that, unfortunately.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I think part of the problem is that, you know, I think there's people are still angry today about it.
I think you're right. We still hear people talking about this.
Actually, one of those manifestations of that anger was the election of Donald Trump, but that's a whole other discussion. But the thing is that people are still angry. They were angry then, and one of the main concerns of people was that these banks were led by human beings, and none of those human beings ever had anything more than a slap of the wrist. The banks would get these fines, these penalties, these huge fines against them that are written off on your taxes, and people understand that there were people who were at the helm of these organizations who had overseen this. Massive, I don't even know how to say it. When you look back at some of these collateralized debt obligations, these fancy investment mechanisms, they knew there were problems, and they continued going ahead with these. And it was not that people are sophisticated economically, but they understood innately that this was not right. We're bailing these banks out, but there's nothing on the other side. We're not getting anything in return.
Brian, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I think there's certainly still a hangover from that sense, and I do think it's contributed to the whole issue of populism. But the bottom line is, look, had we not done that, what would have happened to credit markets would have been unbelievable. Nobody would have been able to borrow anything. There would have been no lending to consumers, no mortgage lending. And in fact, you know, during the height of the crisis, banks weren't lending to each other because nobody knew who had these bad loans on their books. So if banks aren't lending to each other, you know they're not going to lend to you and I. And when you have no credit in your economy, that's a recipe for a depression.
Well, and yeah, that's what the president said in that last clip. So go ahead, Russ.
There was a testimony before Congress that I recall where one of these large Wall Street bank presidents was being chastised for having taken, you know, your bank caused all these problems. It was one of the big ones. I forget the name of it. And yet you, Mr. President, have made $650 million since the year 2000. And he deferred, and he said, no, I didn't make $650 million. It was only $350
million. Oh, dear.
that's as far as he could defend it. And I agree, it was irritating that the people that really benefited greatly from the bad loans, writing bad loans, and ended up really, when you fine a company, it's really the stockholders you're fining. And the CEOs made tons of money still.
Well, today in the Exchange, again, it's our New Hampshire Economic Roundup, where we usually wrap up the top economic stories of recent weeks with our panel. But today we're looking back 10 years since the recession, given that the stock market crashed almost exactly 10 years ago on September 29th. So we're taking a look at that and also how New Hampshire's economy has changed since then. A little bit later, we'll look at some new insights on the connection between population growth and job growth. And then if we've got time, and we hope we do, how economic and demographic trends that we're talking about, that we talk about all the time, may be reshaping our state's transportation debates. But for now, we're looking back 10 years at the economic collapse that, you know, depending on how you measure it, could have happened about a decade ago. And we'd love your thoughts, reflections, questions on what you experienced back then and how you see the state's economy changing. So give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Jeff Feingold, Brian Gottlob, and Russ Tebow. And so, guys, it's really interesting to hear you give this history. So just to move it forward, so President Bush says to the nation, I see what's happening, and here's what my administration wants to do, put forward this bank bailout. It's unpopular. The House rejects it. And then on September 29th, the stock market crashes. Let's just hear a clip of live coverage from that. Again, on September 29, 2008, this clip from Al Jazeera.
The closing bell at the New York Stock Exchange, the main index, down over 7%. Shock and panic evident on the faces of those on the trading floor. Just hours earlier, they'd watched open-mouthed as members of the House of Representatives voted down the $700 billion rescue plan. Wall Street had assumed it would pass.
Again, that's a clip from Al Jazeera 10 years ago. What do you think, Jeff? Wall Street assumed it would pass.
Yeah, well, that's what we call hubris. And I assume they thought it would pass. It would pass in October of 1929 as well, and all those other times. And obviously, what it was just a sign of what was really happening. This underlying anxiety had just really come to a head. And what it also showed, even very starkly, was the international nature of this this collapse, because this, you know, it wasn't just Wall Street that came that went down. You'd see it in London and in Tokyo and all the major markets.
Yeah, it sparked a worldwide
suit.
Recession.
And I remember you'd wake up in the morning and you'd hear the report from Tokyo saying, yeah, it dropped 5% today, and then Hong Kong dropped, and then what's going to happen in New York? And it wasn't just that one day, and it showed the great anxiety everybody had in terms of people started realizing the extent of what this financial I don't know if it's mismanagement or but what they were doing in terms of putting all this money basically riding on this U.S. housing market. And it wasn't just U.S. It was all over the world. I mean, it was, you know, Ireland, all over Europe. But investing in a housing market that's not the kind of investment that you're supposed to be making into these risky investment vehicles.
Well, and after the recession, and you all joined me for these programs, we did tons of programs about underwater mortgages, foreclosures, how these homes were glutting the market. Remember, Russ, we talked a ton about this.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to sitting here today to remember that when today we have about a 4-month inventory of houses available. Everybody's complaining there's no inventory. You can't find a house to buy. But at the trough of the recession, we had almost a 2-year inventory of houses.
Houses
just weren't moving.
Yeah.
People were afraid to buy. Home prices in New Hampshire dropped 20% on average. The median home price dropped 20%. That's a huge hit, which is what, in effect, put a lot of homes under mortgages underwater.
Yeah.
You couldn't sell your house because if you went to a closing, it would cost you money. Yeah. You'd have to pay because the value of your home was less than the balance on your mortgage.
Yeah, that's a big financial hit for someone to take.
Yeah, it really
locked things
up.
People hesitated to take that hit. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Brian, one of the topics we talk about now, 10 years later, all the time on this Econ Roundup, is the shortage of housing. So, seems like something has turned around.
Yeah, certainly something has turned around, although, you know, we still have a shortage, and Russ knows this really well. We still have a shortage of housing in New Hampshire. We really never completely recovered from this last recession in terms of construction activity. And what has been constructed has been, you know, fairly narrowly focused at the higher end of the market. Look, after the recession, the people who recovered fastest and first were higher income households. So, and home builders earn more on more expensive housing, more expensive rental properties. So the incentives were there for them to build at the higher end. And what really hasn't recovered has been more modest priced housing.
I see. That's interesting. So you're saying that, you know, yes, we had this glut of houses that were foreclosed, that owners didn't want to sell, but they didn't know what to do. And sure, that problem has been resolved.
Yeah.
But the shortages we see today are partly tied to skittishness that builders have,
well,
that they don't want to lose
money? There's a lot of reasons why we have a shortage. One is what I said, you know, what we've built has been focused on a more narrow portion of the market, not, you know, for middle income, lower income housing. Haven't seen much of that. It's more difficult in a lot of cases for home builders to build across the state. Material prices are higher. There's a lot of reasons why they can't build. There's a real shortage now of construction workers. I've seen houses in my community that were started months ago that I haven't seen any activity on in 2 months. And why? It's because they don't have the crews. They're working somewhere else. They don't have the construction crews.
Yeah, that's another thing that we talk about every single time we get together, a shortage of skilled workers. Go ahead, Russ.
You know, it bears mentioning that, by and large, we've recovered from this debacle of 2008. But it took us 10 years.
And it was long and slow here in New Hampshire.
This is now the second longest recovery in history, but probably the slowest recovery in history. So, but getting to Brian's point about housing shortages and new construction, I did the math on how many jobs we've added since the trough of the recession, which is around 50 or 55,000. That's really a good performance for the state. But if you do the math on how many houses should we have added, you come up with a shortage of around 20,000 housing units to service the job growth we've had. And to put that into perspective, I don't want to keep rattling off numbers because they're hard to listen to, but 20,000 is the shortage, and we're only building 3,000 or 4,000 a year. So it would take 6 years, if nothing else changed, to get back to a balanced housing market. The shortage, that's by one measure.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I just want to say one other thing. One of the other major hurdles in the creation of housing for workforce housing, affordable housing, whatever you want to call it, is that communities still have this blind spot about building multifamily housing. You know, you see, keep on seeing, like, let's have 55 and older, which is great, but you know, one thing New Hampshire doesn't need is more 55 and older people. But they have this problem with, they still have, it's not based on reality that, you know, that people with young families are going to cost you more money. That's not what the reality is, as has been shown time and time again. But communities have these planning and zoning laws that just prevent construction of these kind
some
of housing.
Communities.
Yeah, I was going to say.
No, there's
some,
a lot of communities
But the problem is that it's a statewide problem, and it's not just in certain one or few.
But it's going to be at the community level that those decisions influence what happens demographically, what happens population-wise, and you see it. We talk about these problems as if they're state problems. They're really local issues, and each community has a lot more control over what can happen in terms of its demographics than we give it credit. We keep looking for state policies when, in fact, we should be looking to influence local planning boards.
That is the real problem, is that if you ask any builder, they know what towns to stay away from, or they'll know what towns they'll have a really hard time with.
Well, eventually, though, Brian, communities like Concord, Dover, guessing, that do invest in this moderate income housing, they'll start to attract the young families.
Yep.
They'll start to have the vibrancy, and the other communities will go, whoa, what's going on? I mean, at some point, right?
Yeah,
that's
what you would hope. That's what you hope. There's plenty
on
of
paper,
us
on paper.
Out there saying that that's what they should do. Look to other communities and what they're doing, their successes. I'm hoping. You never know.
All right. Well, we have a lot more to talk about on our New Hampshire Economic News Roundup in just a moment. When we come back, Jeff Feingold, I want to ask you about manufacturing, what happened during the recession, how that sector has recovered. Also, we should look at employment and wages, and then some news around lots of new jobs coming to the state by an employer known as a very good employer paying good wages. So talk about all that coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A on NHPR. And as a fan of the show, I wanted to let you know that we are coming to New Hampshire and you can be part of the conversation. Join me for an evening of fantastic discussion about issues that matter to you and to the Granite State. Join us on Thursday, October 18th at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord. You can get your tickets right now at ccanh.com. See you then.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our New Hampshire Economic Roundup, where we wrap up the major economic stories of recent weeks. Today, we're looking back 10 years since the stock market crashed on September 29th, 2008. We're looking at what drove that crash and how New Hampshire's economy has evolved and changed since then. Now, a little bit later, we will look at the connection between population growth and job growth here in the state. Also folding in transportation, how those debates are shifting. Let's hear from you. Again, as we do this look back 10 years to how New Hampshire's economy has changed, how has your own economic situation changed since the recession that really hit about a decade ago? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And gentlemen, before we go to our listeners, I do have a couple comments I want to share with you. We've talked a lot about housing and the financial sector. Jeff, let's look at manufacturing. During the recession, there was a lot of emphasis on the hit that manufacturing and construction took. Some even called it a man session, since these industries tend to be dominated by men. I remember doing a whole show on that. Why did these sectors in particular take it so hard, Jeff?
Well, first of all, we were talking a lot about the lack of credit in the U.S. market. In New Hampshire, we had a serious issue. And that without credit, you can't get a mortgage. And that really affected the housing market severely. And when you can't get a mortgage, you can't buy a house, you can't build houses. And that's, in a nutshell, what happened with the construction industry. But manufacturing is a little more complicated. But what it was that in New Hampshire in particular, our manufacturing sector is very, very much reliant on exports internationally. And as I said, this was an international recession. And what happened was we had started seeing signs earlier in 2008 and in 2007 of some weakness in exports, started slowing down. And what happened was it just exacerbated. It became a major, export market just tumbled. And what that affected the employment of people in the manufacturing, all around the country.
The export sector and how strong it is. People don't realize that. You know, you think exports, soybeans or something, but New Hampshire does have a strong export sector. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, manufacturing always takes a hit in a recession.
People want less stuff.
Exactly. Demand falls. It's cyclically sensitive. New Hampshire has a higher percentage of manufacturing in its economy than most states. I mean, we've fallen off a lot, but we're still more manufacturing dependent. When you look at what we manufacture a lot of capital goods as opposed to consumer goods. There are things that are made that are sold to businesses that use them to make other products or
components for larger products.
Yeah, or services or provide services. So when you look at what happened in the recession, business investment fell off dramatically. And as a result, our manufacturing, because it was so dependent on capital goods, was hit even harder. So we saw about a 15 to 16% decline in our manufacturing employment during the recession.
That's a lot.
Yeah,
wow.
It is. The U.S. economy saw a lot too, but we were worse. And in construction, we were a little better. 30% decline in construction during. We lost about 8,000 manufacturing jobs. It was 30% of the construction jobs in New Hampshire.
Maybe a lot of those people just left, Brian. You mentioned earlier that now there's a shortage of construction workers. Maybe a lot of them just said to heck with it.
A lot of them did. First, they looked for employment and other opportunities, which there weren't a lot of. But a lot of them did move or they changed careers. And we really never got them all back. Still haven't gotten them.
Well, the other thing was that you have to remember in 1991, New Hampshire went through a really much more serious real estate depression, really.
Yeah, sure.
And a lot of those people just left. They moved to southern areas, west in the 91. So we already had a deficit in construction workers.
Go ahead, Russ. Yeah.
I was going to say, you look for early warning signs. One of them was manufacturing. I mean, we lost 27,000 manufacturing jobs leading into the recession in New Hampshire. So it was an early warning sign that these good, high-paying, breadwinner jobs were vaporizing. And where they vaporized to was China. The Economic Policy Institute looked at jobs lost to China and estimated them. New Hampshire was in the top five, I think, states in terms of the hit we took with the basically exporting of manufacturing activity to China during the decade of the 2000s.
Oh, some of those jobs, right, Russ? Some people have said, well, maybe not all of them are lost to other markets. They're lost due to automation, and those jobs would have been gone anyway, that it's a little too simple to just say they went over there.
Well,
maybe
a lot of them did. If you look at some of the firms we lost, like Cabletron, for example, that was building components, as Brian said, a lot of them were, I mean, you could almost take a string and draw the line from Rochester, New Hampshire to maybe Shanghai, China.
Really? You could track
it? Not all of them. You're right, Laura. But a sizable portion of our manufacturing activity was vulnerable to a resurgence in the Chinese economy, and
Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I was just going to say one other thing. You know, on the national front, one of the probably the most noticeable sign of the weakness in the manufacturing sector was that among the companies bailed out by the government was General Motors.
I had forgotten about that.
And Chrysler. And
we had the bank bailout and then the auto bailout.
And there are several, not as many as there used to be, but there are several major employers in New Hampshire that supply their big suppliers to the automobile market, especially General Motors, actually. And
again,
this was
these fine components that we manufacture here.
And they lost their prime customer. And that was a really major hit that, you know, it wasn't anything to do with China. I mean, I know I was talking about exports, but this was in the country itself. You know, and that was really a really big hit.
Wow. Well, speaking of manufacturing, got an email here from Christopher who says, the recent announcement that BAE may establish a Manchester division in the old Blue Cross Blue Shield building near the airport is great news. Christopher asks, how will this affect the greater Manchester economy and tech sector? And Christopher, thank you for the email, because we have seen a resurgence in manufacturing in this state. And Jeff, I'm going to turn to you first because you guys covered it. This BAE announcement is huge. Now, for listeners who don't know who or what BAE is, just give us a little bit there, please.
BAE Systems is a aerospace and defense contractor. Its roots in New Hampshire was the old Sanders Associates that people I remember the name of. And
Lockheed Sanders.
Well, it was Sanders.
Or just
then it was
Sanders.
Lockheed Sanders. Yeah, it goes way back to the national. It's birth, born in the Milliard in Nashua, and BAE has been is now it's a UK based company, international conglomerate, and they run the and they have this their aerospace unit is in Nashua, but they also have facilities in Merrimack and Manchester already. And what they want to do is expand in Manchester, which is really very interesting because it says a lot of things. First of all, it talks about it sends a really clear message about their faith in Manchester itself, because Manchester has really gone through a revival. I mean, I know I moved there in July, but I've worked there for 35 years, and it's changed significantly in the last 4 or 5 years.
So 400 jobs, that's a lot of jobs. Do we know what kind of jobs
we're talking
about?
And that's the other thing, because I remember talking to someone from BAE just about a year ago, and they had 500 vacancies in Nashua.
Wow. Yeah.
So this is something else they're saying about the New Hampshire economy. It's like, we've been talking about the workforce shortage. Apparently, BAE Systems has some more confidence in the growth of New Hampshire's labor force than a lot of the other people I talk to, which is great.
Well,
but 400 jobs is a lot, and those are really good jobs. Those are the kind of jobs that we always talk about we need more of in New Hampshire.
And speaking of good jobs in Manchester, there's also the Advanced Regenerative Manufacturing Institute, Dean Kamen's venture in Manchester to create human tissues, starting off for wounded members of the military. This is known as ARMY. ARMY wants to start production of these. It seems amazing in the spring. So, Brian, what hits your ears as an economist when you hear about ARMY, you know, gearing up for production in the spring, 400 quote unquote good paying jobs coming to Manchester? What do you think about?
Well, I mean, obviously it's a good sign, and it's a vote of confidence in the New Hampshire economy. I mean, I've seen signs that the labor force issue, you know, we've complained about it for years, but yet we continue to add jobs at a rate far in excess of what I thought would be possible given the labor force trends. I look at the BAE and the Army as a little bit different. Army is really transformative. It's a new industry. It's a completely new technology. So it will establish Manchester and New Hampshire in general as a leading innovator in a new industry. That has pretty profound implications, because when you look at technologies, there aren't that many places where there's absolutely, you know, the cutting edge of a technology located in one area. And if you can become identified with that, if New Hampshire can become the place where regenerative tissue manufacturing occurs, everybody that wants to be a part of that industry is going to look and say, how can I be a part of that? Can I get close to it? And I think we'll see a lot of new industries that will spring up as a result of that. That's a real different than BA, which is a great company, but it's something that can be done in a lot of places. When it's a new technology, it doesn't get spread around. It concentrates.
There's no downside to this. The 400 jobs that BA he is introducing to the Manchester economy will support at least another 400 jobs in the service industry.
Sure, because those employees will get coffee in the morning.
Yeah, they'll spend money at Market Basket. They'll buy legal services. So the multiplier effect of those 400 jobs, because it's all fresh money into the economy. It's like fresh water in a fish tank that's very healthy. And, you know, you can debate about the multiplier. Some would say it's going to be twice that of other kinds of jobs. So it's big because it's fresh money and it's good high-paying jobs, which is what has been a real challenge for the state to garner.
Is Manchester, your hometown now, although you've worked there for a long time, Jeff, is Manchester and the area around it, I mean, not everybody's going to live in downtown Manchester, is Manchester and the surrounding area, which I would say extends up to Concord, it's only 20 miles away, you know, is Manchester ready? I mean, roads, housing, schools, is Manchester ready for this type of influx?
I would say they want to be ready, but I don't think that the city is ready. And that's one of the concerns is that, especially when it comes to housing and also, you know, really with the schools itself, the schools, there's an
lots
effort.
Lots of concern about the schools
there's
in Manchester.
There's an effort right now in Manchester that's being initiated by business people, but involves the whole community called Manchester Proud, which are trying to elevate the schools in Manchester, because they understand that with this army and with this BAE announcement, there'll be people who want to live in Manchester, and they're young people with families, and you have to have the schools at that level that they expect. I just also wanted to say one other thing, that I live in the Mill Yard, and I walk my dog every morning, and right across from us is where the army initiative is housed.
Oh, interesting.
And there already are businesses and people working in there. I mean, to Brian's point, they're attracting companies, and they're not New Hampshire companies. It's companies coming from elsewhere to set up shop at this Army, what they call BioFab USA, to actually do the work that's being done. I mean, and once it starts getting into higher level, there'll be even more companies coming in.
Go ahead, Brian.
Just a quick comment on something Jeff said. The challenge in Manchester, like it is in a lot of communities, is to take this wonderful opportunity that they have and translate it into something more than just property tax revenue. You know, how do you translate it into community development? And I don't want to name names, but I see different communities reacting differently to these opportunities. They get a significant employer or they get several employers and they say, wow, that's wonderful. Now, you know, we'll help lower our property tax base, which is great, but the real challenge is to take all the opportunity that's now being dropped in Manchester's lap, and can they turn it into real community development? Like, how do they benefit all the citizens of their community by improving the quality of their services, schools in particular, but also the amenities that the communities offer? That's what's going to keep people who are attracted to Army and BA wanting to live in Manchester as opposed to going to Bedford or all the surrounding communities, like they, honestly, what they do now.
Which is and
what,
there's plenty of surrounding communities that would love to have these folks, although it is a tricky balancing act. I appreciate what you're saying, Brian, because you also don't want people to look at the area and go, well, I kind of want to live in this town, but property taxes are really high.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, you can't.
Exactly.
You got to balance it out.
It's a balance. They just tend, some communities just say it's only about lowering the property taxes instead of how do we make our community better as a result of this opportunity.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Go ahead, Russ, your thoughts there. Is Manchester ready for this?
Well, I agree. I think that it's a balancing act. We've seen a lot of reinvestment in, for example, where Macy's used to be in Bedford, Londonderry. We've talked about Salem and Tuscan Village. But I think that what will happen is this is a big enough deal that the impacts are going to be spread across the region. They're going to be regional. So although Manchester might like to garner all of the spin-off benefits of this, the fact of the matter is it's going to be a regional kind of play. And I think you'll see people commuting from Concord, for example, to some of these jobs. But nonetheless, it's just a great thing to see, to have this fresh influx of new money.
Well, I want to ask all you guys how some of this development is going to affect our transportation systems. But first, a couple emails from our listeners. Going back to our earlier conversation about the financial crash and how that all shook out, Dean says, could one of your guests give a synopsis of the sequence of Federal Reserve actions during the recession and after, such as providing liquidity to the market, Operation Twist, etc.? Dean, good memory. I forgot. Operation Twist, of course. All this stuff from 10 years ago. Thank you so much, Dean. Can you do a brief synopsis, Russ?
Yeah, I think that that the main things that happened was the Fed stepped up and lowered interest rates. Okay, aggressively lowered interest rates.
And they've stayed low.
And they've stayed low. But they're edging up now. Well, you're looking at around a 5% mortgage rate now instead of a 3.5%. So appropriately, they're edging back up. So one thing was the Fed can control short-term interest rates, and they did. They did so aggressively. The other thing that they did, which was the purchasing of long-term mortgage-backed securities, they provided liquidity. If a bank in Germany was concerned about their mortgage portfolio that they had bought into, probably erroneously, the Fed said, look, don't worry, we'll buy it, and we'll give you cash that you can lend to other people. We'll take that on ourselves. And that's still, it's like an $80 trillion balance sheet of the Fed, which is unprecedented. So the main thing is they gave liquidity to the market. They gave lenders a way out.
Liquidity means basically just cash.
Yeah. If you were trapped in a closet as a lender, they unlocked the door so you could get out of the problem and function more normally. And it was a great. Ben Bernanke did a great job, and as I think averted really an international disaster. There were still international problems. Greece, we might remember. Spain, where lenders just said, look, you're too risky. You got too much debt. We're not going in there anymore. So there were still problems. And locally, it was more on the mortgage side of things. So
local banks felt the crunch, too.
Yes, but the interesting thing is that the stress was, I think, primarily focused on Wall Street. The problems in New Hampshire weren't created by New Hampshire banks. They were created by mortgage companies, out-of-state mortgage companies. And I think New Hampshire banks, Jeff mentioned the 1990 downturn, learned a lesson then. And we didn't lose any banks in this downturn.
They became much more cautious. Go ahead, real quick,
Jeff. I do have to say, though, one of the fallout of this was, I remember talking to several bankers, I guess it was about 2009, maybe 2010. But the talk had been for at least a couple of years how difficult it was for small businesses to get any kind of financing. That was going on for a long time. It was really hard for a business to get financing from their banks because the rules had changed. And the community banks said their hands were tied and they couldn't lend the money to who they maybe would have a few years earlier. And that was really something that they really hamstrung New Hampshire in terms of any kind of ability for these companies to grow as the way they wanted to. And it's taken a long time to get out of that whole mess, because it was a mess. It was very difficult to get any kind of loan.
Well, Dean, thank you for the email and for the reminder. I'd forgotten about some of those things that you mentioned. So thank you, Dean. And coming up, I want to pull together all these trends that we've talked about, including the workforce trends and the housing trends and so forth, and ask how it might affect debates over transportation here in New Hampshire. There are a couple interesting headlines about that just recently. So that is coming up. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, our New Hampshire Economic News Roundup is back, and we've been digging deeper into the past, looking at the recession, which hit New Hampshire about a decade ago when the stock market crashed on September 29th, 2008, and all that has spun out since then. But we're also looking ahead to how New Hampshire's economy has changed. And as we're hearing from our guests, there have been some very good announcements about the New Hampshire economy recently. We'd love to get your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, nhpr.org. And all of you, so we've been talking about the announcement by BAE Systems, 400 jobs coming in. We've been talking about Dean Kamen's Army, the Advanced Regenerative Tissue Manufacturing Institute, and all those jobs coming in. We've been looking at the Manchester area, larger than just the city itself, and how ready it is. And I wonder what you think, Brian. I'll turn to you first, but I want to hear from everybody. How are these employment issues, these workforce issues, affecting New Hampshire's longstanding debates over our transportation system, which is basically roads and cars?
Yeah, I think it's really significant because, you know, one, commuting times have gotten longer. I've sort of tracked this over the last few decades, and almost every county in the state and every community, commuting times have gotten longer and longer. All these issues are interrelated because if you can't have people living near where they work, which, you know, we don't seem to do a great job of having, you know, a lot of housing located in places that, that are expanding their employment, then you've got to move people from where they live to where they work. And that's how you kind of balance out where there's places where there's excess labor or available labor with the places that are adding a lot of jobs but don't have enough people. I was in Keene doing a presentation last week, and, you know, it's a wonderful place to live. I love that community, just great. And they're, they're complaining about, and rightly so, about the lack of jobs and lack of, their housing prices are lower. The problem is, and they've got talent there, the problem is it's really hard for those people to work in Manchester. You know, it's not easy to travel Route 101. So, you know.
But maybe the flip side of that is it's not such a bad thing because you build it at home. You can't get to Boston easily. You can't get to Manchester easily. You can't get to Concord easily. So you build it at home.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, they're not building it at home. They continue to build it in the places where they're, you know, there's an agglomeration effect where there's a lot of employers. So they're going to continue to build in the Manchester area. They're going to continue in London area. They're going to continue to build in Portsmouth and places like are missing out, and yet it's a place that could help solve the housing situation because there's available housing at relatively affordable prices. But you got to move people. So we're not, unless we have people living, more people living where they work, we're going to have to figure out how to move them. Hopefully not by cars, public transportation, which again is a real mess in the state. There just really is almost no public transit, with the exception, the Seacoast has a little bit of it.
Over on the Seacoast, you've got the train, which stops in Durham, Exeter, and Dover, right?
Yep,
so
yep.
Three stops on the coast.
Exactly. We've got the train. We've got pretty good bus service. And we've got intercommunity bus service over there. So it actually is pretty effective. But most places aren't like that.
So when I lived in Keene a long time ago, I'm talking decades ago, Russ, there was better transportation to Boston back then than there is now.
And when I lived in Manchester decades ago, there was better transportation around the city. I took the bus to the library when I was a kid. So, I mean, I think that the pattern of development in the state has been driven by the automobile. We're spending a gazillion dollars on 93. We're about to spend another gazillion dollars on the turnpike on the 93 through Concord. But we read in the news this week or last week about a firm in Salem that is leaving. It's not a large firm, but is leaving because of the lack of a train access to a broader labor force. So we continue to put a lot of money into the automobile. The pattern of development in the state favors the automobile, disfavors public transportation, and
well,
that's
and
where
self-driving
we are.
Cars. People say as these come on the market, more and more people will say, "Forget sticking to that train or bus schedule. You know, I don't want to leave at 6 o'clock in the morning. I want to leave at 6:15."
We're
so
seeing
I'm
a lot more people on
the
bicycles too, and I know that that's your personal experience.
Well, actually, a lot of people bike into Pease. So you commute by
to
bike
catch
to
the buses there. Which
they work there.
Oh, they work there.
They
okay.
work to Pease. They bike into Pease. There's I don't know how many people there are, but there's quite a few that do that every day. I have to say, I was a former resident of Keene many years ago, and this discussion, Keene, it's not necessarily by choice that Keene is so isolated. One of the main reasons is that Route 101 was expanded many years ago from Manchester to Seacoast, but Route 101 from Keene to Manchester is a 1940s road, and that's really been one of the problems that Keene has faced.
Well, we did a whole series this summer called Going Local, where we looked at the different strengths and drawbacks of each region, and this definitely came up when we did our Monadnock region show, which actually, to toot our own horn a little bit, we did live before an audience at Keene State College. That was really great. Lots more people want to jump into our conversation. So let's go back to our listeners. And Jill's calling in from Peterborough. Jill, good to hear from you. You're on the Economic Roundup. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
It's really nice to hear about all this great economic development that's happening in Manchester and the Seacoast and Nashua, and how there's going to be all these great jobs with lots of money and everything. But, you know, you did mention it sort of briefly underneath, was that this makes the property taxes go down in those areas. And those of us who live in, well, I now refer to it as East Vermont, the second CD, in the rural areas, our property taxes are still through the roof. I just sold my house of 33 years because property taxes were taking 20% of my income.
Wow,
I'm semi-retired.
Jill.
I can't do this anymore.
Sure.
And until the state changes the taxing structure so that all those economic benefits that happen over there in the concentrated areas can be spread across the state, you're still going to have people like me in the more rural areas of the state who are paying taxes through the nose to keep this, you know, wonderful New Hampshire advantage that we have.
Well, Jill, it's so good to hear from you. And Russ, I remember when Steve Norton was still at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, he came on all the time saying, it's a tale of two cities here in New Hampshire. And Brian alluded to this earlier, too. The development is sort of pocketed and scattered and really much depends on decisions made at the local level.
Yeah, we did some work.
And the state level, to Jill's point.
With Dennis DeLay, our good friend.
Yeah. Passed away
on housing needs in New Hampshire. And what one of the things that was really striking was the number of elderly, say 65 and over, who have no mortgage but are still paying more than 35% of their income for housing costs between our high
That's
utility
a lot.
Costs and high property taxes. And I know that Michael Kitch did a nice article on Jeff's publication about tax rates. I think that the pressure for tax reform is increasing here in New Hampshire. There was a recent article in Jeff's publication from the policy guy at the Business and Industry Association talking about the disparities. Yeah. So, Jeff, I'll just turn it over. If I may, Laura, I'll turn it over to Jeff because they've done a lot of good work on this.
Yeah, we've been following this. We actually have an article in our current issue on looking at the 19 largest, what they call property poor communities, and the disparities there, you know, the rates they pay, their median ages are higher, their job opportunities are much lower, their education levels are much lower. It's a really it's a very stark look at just basically the numbers of what's going on around the state. But the real concern about this whole thing is that, as Jill said, you know, it's there are areas of the state that are very healthy, very strong. We've talked so much about the North Country, but it's not just the North Country. It's other parts of the state, southwestern New Hampshire, parts of western New Hampshire, you know. And it's not. It's really something that we need to look at as a state. You know, we do have what we call local control. We think it is, but it's something that really needs to look at because we can't really move too far forward without if we're going to leave so much of our state behind.
Wow, and you're really whetting my appetite for maybe next time we get together. We kind of look at this issue that Jill brings up and that you guys have talked about. And Jill, thank you so much that development is happening in a very sort of pocketed, differentiated way. And Brian, I'd just love your thoughts there.
Yeah, one of the encouraging things, however, I don't want to be totally contrarian. I see pockets of encouragement. You know, when I look at what's happened to job growth over the last year, it's been stronger than we had anticipated. I think a lot of people anticipated based on the labor force growth. But you see it, it's actually been more widely spread in the state. I track job growth in our major employment areas, the Seacoast area, Manchester and Nashua, and outside of those areas. And where the real strength has been, where it's really taken off, has been outside of those areas. So while it's not the headlines, it's not the armies, and it's not the BAEs, it is reaching out a little bit further. And I think it's happening because, one, there's less space in some of these areas. There's, you know, more labor constraints, and it's more costly. So I think some employers are looking a little bit further out.
Okay, so topic for next time we get together. Brian, I know you have to leave a little bit early, so we really appreciate you being here today.
Pleasure to be here. As always, and to my colleagues, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. So, Jeff and Russ, a couple more emails coming in from our listeners. Trent in Concord says, when and if Dean Kamen's Army venture fails or continues to require subsidies, will our economist friends finally say we shouldn't continue to pick winners and losers? Subsidizing businesses leaves taxpayers on the hook for when they fail, leaving companies dependent, and we shouldn't do it. I'm going to turn to you first on this, Jeff. If you could just clarify the level of subsidy that Army is getting, and we've been trying, by the way, to put a whole show together on this. And I think they're so busy over there that we've had a hard time getting those folks on the air. But the Defense Department invested some in this, but a lot of it is private.
Over $80 million.
Private university funding and other institutes.
Yeah,
but go ahead.
And actual, you know, corporations are investing in it.
So $80 million from the DOD. So yes. Trent is right. There's a big subsidy there from the DOD.
Yeah, well, they saw Dean Kamen out, which is part of the story of Army, which when you do your show, you can discuss
sure.
that. But I think what he's talking about is a legislation that was passed in this last session that gives companies that that set up
state subsidies
related to Army,
yes,
related to regenerative medicine, they get 10-year break on their business profits or business enterprise tax,
which is very unusual in the state.
I think that's what he's
talking about. New Hampshire usually does not.
As far as I know, it was the first time I've ever done anything like that.
Okay, Trent, point clarified.
Is a point, and I think that the legislators, from what I understand, were convinced that this is a once in a like as Brian was saying, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity for not just Manchester but the state to. Pony up something and say, look, we really want this industry to set up in New Hampshire because it's a unique opportunity. All that aside, Trent brings up some philosophical issues about this as it goes to the core of New Hampshire. And as I said, this is not something that's been done before.
Well, and there's never enough time, gentlemen, but I do like to close out by asking you, Russ, what economic numbers, trends, reports you'll be looking at in the weeks ahead?
I'm looking for where's the next shoe to drop going to come from. And I think that if you look at there was a recent article in the New York Times that did a great job. We have an awful lot of debt that has been built up. Student debt, corporate debt, government debt. Federal debt is now 105% of GDP. And I think that there's a lot of air in the balloon in terms of debt. And now it's not the housing debt that we had at the last downturn, but it's a lot of debt. And if rates are going to go up, the cost of that debt's going to go up. And maybe some people are going to bail on it. And so when I look for the warning sign, that's the one that I think is most prominent in my mind.
Well, and again, to give you credit, you gave warning signs back in 2005, 2006 about those weird mortgages that people were seemingly not worried about. So how about you, Jeff? What are you going to be looking
at? Actually, I'm looking at a little more micro thing there's an interesting article in the Times the other day about how the housing market's slowing down around the country.
I'm interested in
seeing the numbers as they come out later this month. To see if this is continuing, and specifically in New Hampshire, because there had been some signs of it slowing down a little bit.
Okay. Can't wait till you guys come back, because we've already got lots to talk about. Thank you so much for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.